Hi. The last time we took you behind the scenes of the Kyiv Independent in mid-February, we explained how we hoped our independent media would be sustainable. We had just recently hit 20,000 Twitter followers, which was a very big deal at the time. We'd also gotten our first ever paychecks after months of hard, free, stressful, but loving labor to keep our new media startup alive. And just 12 days later, February 24th, everything changed. Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, and the life we all knew before was gone in an instant. My name is Alina Lyam-Kent, and you're listening to Media in Progress. The aim of this podcast series was to record how a team of passionate journalists fought for their values by establishing a fully independent English-language media company in Ukraine. Against the odds and in the face of skepticism, it could be done. It was a Media in Progress, with us starting things from scratch. Our editors became managers, our nights became sleepless, but our values never faded. It was another late night at the office on February 23rd. Our editor-in-chief, Olga Rudenko, deputy editor, Toma Istomina, and political editor and chief of operations, Alexei Sorokin, were at the office until 3 in the morning. As they left the office and were about to go their separate ways, Toma nervously joked, "Well, hope to see you tomorrow." They wouldn't. They didn't see each other in person for quite some time. Alexei Sorokin made it back home after their goodbyes.
I took a cab back home. I entered my apartment. I was sent a link of Putin's speech to the Russian nation, where he basically declares a war in Ukraine. And that exact moment, I understand that the war had begun. I call my dad. It's like 4:30 a.m. I tell my dad, "Wake up, war." I hang up and I hear explosions, like two big massive explosions outside my house. They were in Kyiv. Also, Kharkiv was bombed. So from that day, we started working 24/7. We didn't have a day off.
The Kyiv Independent had some preparations in place in case the worst did come. Withdrawn cash in case the banking systems fell through, giving our website passwords to our people in North America who could then pick up the work if everyone in Ukraine was cut off from the internet. Thankfully, that didn't happen. Despite worries of cyber attacks, the internet stayed up. And in the first moments of the full-scale invasion, we posted on our website. On February 24th, 4:57 a.m., the main post on the Kyiv Independent site read in all caps, "Putin declares war on Ukraine," leading with, "Russian President Vladimir Putin announced that Russia will conduct a special military operation to demilitarize Ukraine, effectively declaring a major war on the country."
We did not, like some media call it, for Russia's leader, call it special operation, like Putin declared a special operation. That's bullshit. So we called it a war in the first seconds of it.
After that post, the first thing that our editor-in-chief, Olga Rudenko, did was go to sleep.
After those first communications with the team, I actually felt that I'm going to die if I don't sleep now, because I haven't slept that night and I haven't slept much in the previous couple of nights. So I actually took like a 1 hour nap on the morning when the full-scale invasion started. After that, I kind of tried to pretend like life is going on, so I went to the office, and I was here alone for maybe an hour before realizing that probably I need to try to get out of Kyiv myself too, because again, that was the first day. We didn't know what was going to happen, but we already heard the explosions. We already heard, you know, Kyiv was already targeted from the air, and we didn't know where things were going to go. Maybe Kyiv was going to be invaded in a couple of days. Maybe communications were going to be cut off. And I had this responsibility of the team of journalists who have a very important mission in these circumstances.
That night, she left Kyiv for Western Ukraine by train before the mass evacuations started. She stayed in a small town in Western Ukraine for the next 5 to 6 weeks, working undisrupted as it wasn't a target for the Russian missiles. She could work without having to go into a bomb shelter without internet access, which some of our journalists were doing the following days.
We decided to spend the night in the bomb shelter under the nearest school. So we took our kids, 3 kids, 15 years old, 6 years old, and 1 year old, all girls.
Our business reporter, Natalia Dastkevich, lived on the left bank of Kyiv, not too far from Boryspil Airport, where some of the initial missiles hit during the first attack.
And we went to the school for the night. They were overcrowded. It was really a big mess there because there was children crying, dogs, cats, elderly. So everybody was there sitting. So we decided to go not in the shelter, but on the first floor. Well, it was I still think it was the geographic, the class of geography, with a big panorama windows. So we sat there. And right at 4:50, that was the moment I will never forget. Never. The sky became orange, and there's this awful sound of this rocket flying near our neighborhood. And we just ran extremely fast to this bomb shelter in the basement. And yes, I was literally shaking. My leg was just unstoppably shaking. It was the fear you would never expect from you. Your brain just completely shut down, and you just feel this strange feeling that you cannot think about anything. You're just shaking. You just don't know what to do.
The family then had to pay $250 for a taxi to take them to a village in Chernihiv Oblast, hoping to find safety. But instead, they found themselves surrounded. Russian tanks had entered the surrounding villages. Blocked in, they spent the next 3 weeks there. Until one day,
my husband just went to this grocery store to buy some milk for kids, and then it was in the morning, and he called me back in 10 minutes like, hey, there is one man who agreed to take us to Kyiv. And we were like, okay. So we packed like in just, I don't know, half an hour, clothes and belongings.
What usually was a 1.5 hour drive took 5 instead. They had to take a different route than the usual. That one was completely taken over by the Russian forces and full of mines. After dozens of checkpoints, the family didn't bother to go home. They went straight to the train station.
I was so scared for my kids, for their lives. It was my mission to save them.
They then experienced what millions of Ukrainians have experienced in the last 5 months. The overcrowded train stations, mob panic, and sleepless hours until they finally crossed the border into Poland.
As soon as we step off from this train, I was extremely, extremely happy, because I realized that no danger for my kids. There is no danger for my kids. The rocket won't hit from out of the blue, and my mission at this point is completed. So I was so, so happy to get out of this hell, which was extremely, extremely hard to realize that when you are sitting in this village, you just don't know what to expect in the next hour. It's really, really hard.
While those with families moved out of Kyiv and the danger zones, other team members stayed, reporting from the hotspots. Igor Kosov, Ilya Ponomarenko, and Anya Miranyuk were among those in the hot zones.
I knew that if this war happened, it would be something I have to write about, because I'm half Russian, I'm half Ukrainian, I'm American, I'm a journalist, I'm here, I'm prepared. It's practically my destiny, if that were such a thing.
Our reporter, Igor Kosov.
It's practically the most important work of my life, because of how important and how damaging this war is, and what it has already destroyed and what it threatens to destroy in the future.
The Kyiv Independent understood that we stood at the informational front lines of this war, and no matter what, we had to continue to do our jobs.
I guess similar to how I motivate myself, ordinarily I have a sense that I need to be producing something. If I don't produce it, I start getting more and more anxious. That's just how my body works. When I work on something, when I do the assignments that I've given myself or are given to me, I feel like a satisfaction, like this is what I should be doing, that I'm doing what I ought to be doing, and that keeps me going.
Whatever burnout we may have been experiencing from the months of endless work of creating a media startup was gone. We had a new mission this time, with much higher risks.
I think it's gonna sound weird, but I got used to working 24/7, if that's even possible. When the war started, I would even go back. We were working 24/7 since November, when we found this news outlet, but then we had a sense of urgency. We had to create something till it's hot, till people who believe in us are willing to commit their free time unpaid to this project. So we had the sense that we owe this people, our people, a new news outlet that will respect them, that will bring them financial stability, and that will allow our readers to receive credible information. And we worked in this 24/7 schedule since November. And then obviously the Russian military buildup and the eventual war, the full-out war that started, forced us also to work 24/7 and to basically deliver news from Ukraine. So this was kind of adrenaline that kept us going. And now I feel that we're so used to working 24/7 that it would probably be very weird for me to take a day off.
Alexei is right. As per usual, the work was 24/7, coordinating shifts so that people could sleep a couple of hours at a time. The key of Indy's teamwork, adaptability, and flexibility, once again, was a saving grace.
And this is gonna sound weird, but I don't feel fatigue. Obviously, it comes in waves. I talked, for example, to Toma recently, and she had a period of time where she was very tired and it was hard for her to work. I had a period of time like this, like a week, where I forced myself to work. But in general, I would say that we know why we are doing this. We know why we are working so hard, and this is what keeps us going. This means that our work is needed, that our work is appreciated, and that basically we need to continue because it's nobody except us.
Although many international journalists had been in Kyiv for weeks waiting for something to happen, they weren't local. They didn't know Ukraine. We did. We had our contacts, our sources. We had journalists with experience covering this war since 2014. And we certainly didn't mix up cities and names. And people recognized this. Many people. That number of 20,000 followers that we had built with so much effort over the course of a few months skyrocketed to 1.5 million within a span of a week. A few days later, on March 1st, the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen quoted us during a speech to the European Parliament.
Honourable members, this is a moment of truth for Europe. And let me quote the editorial of one Ukrainian newspaper, the Kyiv Independent, published just hours before the invasion began, and I quote, "This is not just about Ukraine. It's a clash of two worlds, two polar set of values." End of quote. They are so right.
She wouldn't be the only one to cite us. CNN, New York Times, The Economist, Obama, the world's leading news organizations were referencing our team. Ilya Ponomarenko, our war correspondent, has become one of the most influential voices of our team and the country, with 1.2 million Twitter followers reading his war updates. As an independent media organization, not afraid to call Russia out for their war crimes and misdeeds, we are a regular story at Russia Today, a Russian state-controlled media outlet, spouting conspiracies about fake investigations on us and other ridiculous tales. The worldwide attention allowed us to not only reach our GoFundMe goal, but surpass it. It has so far raised over $1.9 million. Our patrons have increased to over 6,600, racking over $64,600 per month.
Even though I am kind of happy about everything that Kyiv Independent has achieved, but it just doesn't feel to me like a celebration. I wish we had the opportunity to implement our strategy step by step. We'll grow slower, but it would be without the war. And it was a weird experience, but overall good. I'm happy I went.
Our CEO, Darina Shevchenko, has returned to Kyiv after her initial few weeks in Western Ukraine. Although she was offered to work from abroad, a safer and possibly more productive environment, it was too painful to be away, she says. Even with the curfew, air raid sirens, she's home. And this matters so much.
I'm very happy. You know, a lot of people ask me, like, how on earth did it happen that Kyiv Independent became the voice of Ukraine? Like, Kyiv Independent was designed to be the voice of Ukraine. It was the plan from the very beginning. And we had everything set up to be the voice of Ukraine. You know, we worked on a lot of things very fast during these 3 months before the war that we were actually an organization. And it's not a coincidence or something.
We did a lot of smart things before the full-scale invasion, Darina explains. It was good we already had a growing readership on multiple platforms. We were present on Twitter and Facebook. We had a core audience who already knew about us and was sharing us to their circles, who shared it to other circles, and so on. We also diversified revenue streams.
And frankly, for this, I'm praising myself a lot, because in the beginning, a lot of people were telling me to go just for one or two revenue streams, and I said, no, I will go for pretty much all of them. All the revenue streams I know exist.
We had donor funding, crowdsourced funding, membership, and commercial revenues. We didn't have to hastily launch a campaign when the full-scale war happened. We already had them set up. We had a GoFundMe, we had a Patreon, we had preliminary donor agreements and actual donor money in our account. We did, of course, lose our commercial revenues overnight. Everyone did.
But for a lot of media organizations, it was like 80% of their budget. For us, it was, I don't know, 5-10, and we had the rest, and it was a very smart thing to do in the beginning.
Since we were meeting such success with our fundraising, the Kyiv Independent started a second fundraising campaign to help other Ukrainian media organizations and journalists. Called Keep Ukraine's Media Going, it can be found on the top of our website, right next to our Patreon and initial GoFundMe startup buttons.
It was kind of insane, like in those first days and weeks we were, you know, on the one hand, we were living through this whole shock of the war, of the invasion happening, of Kyiv being bombed and so on. And at the same time, in parallel universe, we were seeing these numbers on our social media accounts and the website, and our fundraising campaign was exploding. And it was like two parallel things that, you know, we would post or edit or write some horrible news, and then sometimes every once in a while somebody said in the work chat, hey guys, have you seen what's going on with our GoFundMe campaign? It's insane. And we would like take a look and be like, huh, that's cool, and then go back to writing.
There hasn't been much processing of the success yet because we really haven't had the time to stop.
While we are grateful for the attention and for the donations, we don't get cocky. We don't feel like it's an amazing success. There's never like, you know what I mean? There's never a celebratory mode. Like, there's never like, let's open a bottle of champagne, because all of it is happening at the backdrop of this war. And it's kind of strange, because if it happened to us like in a peaceful time, if we hit 2 million followers on Twitter at this time, we would probably like throw a party about it, you know? And now it's like, oh, okay, let's keep working.
The work never stops, and Russia's war crimes continue daily. Seeing the situation on the ground motivates the team to continue. But of course, it's extremely difficult.
It's hard to talk about how I feel while we're at war, and all the feelings are quite mixed. There is fear, happiness because you are alive, but also worry for your relatives, and many other feelings that you feel at once. So short answer is, I guess since I am alive, I am all right. Long answer is, it's not always that simple. And I think that mental toll that the war has on us is huge, and it is difficult to keep sane in all that.
Our head of investigations, Anya Miranyuk, alongside Igor and Ilya, was one of our journalists in the hotspots of Kyiv when the Russians were attacking the capital city. As our lead investigative journalist, she's taken many trips to regions such as Bucha, Irpin, and Hostomel, where horrendous mass murders and war crimes occurred. She's not new to war, having covered it in Donbass after 2014, but the cruelty and violence she's witnessed on the ground is soul-crushing.
I'm not being naive, I understand it's war, but what really made me have a lot of thinking was the amount of violence I have seen during this war. It is definitely a very violent war. What Russians do, the atrocities they commit are comparable to little, I guess.
Before I sat down with Anna, she had recently come back from a trip to Bucha, a suburb outside of Kyiv that Russians occupied from the 27th of February to the 31st of March. The photos and stories left of the people shocked the world.
Recently, I had to go to Bucha to find information about a young woman called Karina. She was killed just a week before her 23rd birthday. She was tortured by the Russians, and as her family claims, it believes she was raped before being tortured and killed. The information about her death was very fragmentary, and I needed to put all the pieces into one picture, and I had to figure out what really happened to her. I first went to the morgue, trying to talk to people who might have seen her body, who might have participated in the exhumation of her body. So it was something I've never seen before, because the morgue was full of cars that were packed with black bags with bodies of dead and tortured by the Russians people there in those bags. The smell was unbearable. It was so surreal to see these bodies and the policemen working there. Because I froze for a second, I guess. I was just looking at this car filled with these black bags. And I was thinking, like, these are people inside, real people who lived their lives, dreamt about something, had their plans for the future. They might have loved someone, they might have hated someone. They had jobs, they had friends, they had relatives, they had their stories to tell, but we would never probably hear them. They're gone now because of the Russians who killed them.
What had shocked Anna is the amount of murderous hatred the Russians have towards ordinary Ukrainian women. It's clear based on the wounds found on their bodies. Karina was tortured for a while and most likely raped, until she was shot in the head. She's among many Ukrainian women who suffered the same fate. Similarly, another woman that Anna reported on was trying to escape with her family, her husband and her two small children, to find safety in the early days of the war. As they drove on the highway, she was shot by a Russian sniper.
She was shot dead by a Russian sniper in front of her two little boys, two sons. There is no way a Russian sniper didn't see that she was shooting in the head a woman, a mother, not a military, just a Ukrainian mother of kids. And then when the car stopped, they shot her husband in one leg, then in another one, and then they shot a kid, her son and his son. Boys and their father survived, but they were heavily injured. So probably what I would like to highlight and what message I would like to pass is that there is so much violence in the Russian soldiers. Russian atrocities are so terrifying and so inhumane that it's really difficult for a normal human being to comprehend. So my hope as a journalist is just that everyone who committed war crimes on Ukraine's soil will be persecuted and brought to justice. That's the idea that keeps me going and that helps me to wake up every morning.
While Igor was in a neighborhood around Kyiv, he heard similar stories. A photo of his circulated Twitter of a car with a paper taped to the window with the word children written on it. That particular window was the one with the bullet hole. Not the driver's seat, not the passenger. The back seat, where the children sat. Although the story that he decided to tell me more about when we sat down to talk was about the humanity of Ukrainians.
I think my most memorable story of the war so far was the one with the two volunteers when I embedded with them. The whole day turned out to be ideal. That's when we went into Stoyanka 2, like I said, to bring out the bodies, but we ended up rescuing two living people instead. The whole day was relatively quiet. I mean, we did get mortared at one point, but that was just three shots. And the Russians had pulled out of the Stoyanka 2 checkpoint, and there was very little gunfire, but the whole day unfolded with this perfect narrative structure. It's almost like I was a character in a book. It just unfolded perfectly. I feel like that day, watching just these people put themselves in harm's way to help others that they don't know, it reminded me that despite the worst of humanity that we saw the Russians perpetrate, we also see some of the best of humanity that Ukrainian volunteers and others helping people have demonstrated. And that's why that day stands out to me.
As we enter the sixth month of this war, some parts of the world's focus have shifted. Domestic scandals, other terror attacks, time is also an enemy. That is where we come in.
We need to make sure that the whole world is watching and hearing about all these tragic humanitarian stories that is behind the headline.
Our staff writer Asami, whose stories are published almost daily, is motivated to report and document as many Russian war crimes as possible. And as they continue to pile up, so does her work and her drive.
We need to make sure that the world is witnessing all of this and that everyone in the world is reading about it, because that's how, you know, we can punish Russia for it, what it's done. We need witnesses in the world to support us. And I believe that because of the journalists' work, not just us, but from other media and freelance journalists as well, we're able to tell the world better about what's happening here, how people's lives are being affected, and trying to communicate that to the world.
The evidence and reports gathered by journalists will be vital when the international institutional courts persecute Russia for its crimes. Meanwhile, while working with such a workload, Asami is still a university student. Her university has been very flexible because of the situation and the vital work she's doing at the moment.
But I think that eventually I would have to do some things because I plan to graduate on time.
Our team is made up of truly fantastic individuals. Alongside the worldwide recognition the Kyiv Independent has received, our members have also won some international recognition. Toma Istomina, Аня Миронюк, Алексей Сорокин, and Анастасия Лопатина were included by Forbes magazine in the top 30 under 30 leaders in the media and marketing. Less than 6 months after founding the English language publication, these Ukrainian journalists have shown bravery, tenacity, sensitivity, and impact while reporting on a war in their home country, Forbes wrote.
I like how Forbes wrote it that the company has, the Kyiv Independent has 24 co-founders, basically, because obviously, I'm not gonna lie, there are people who were crucial to this project. I would say Olga Rudenko, Toma Istomina, Anna Miranyuk, who basically pulled this project together, who made this project, this news outlet, what it is. But there's also 15, 20 people who believed in this project, who worked for free, who worked 24/7, who knew that, who entrusted this group of people into building something out of basically nothing, because we were fired, we didn't have anything. And I think that it's important to mention every time we receive some kind of award or a mention that there is 24 people put the effort who put their time, their money, everything in what we know as the Kyiv Independent today.
Soon after, the world would see our editor-in-chief Olga Rudenko's face on the cover of Time magazine, honoring the work of Ukrainian journalists against the Russian invasion. Olga wasn't expecting to be on the cover.
I mean, if you told me several months ago, you know, can we like put your face on the Time cover, I would probably die of anxiety, honestly, like just thinking of the idea of seeing my face on it.
But after experiencing stress from waiting for the news of Azovstal and reporting on human tragedies daily, being on a magazine cover isn't something she has the time to freak out about these days.
I mean, I understand how important and symbolic it is, and it's definitely such a recognition, such an important recognition of our work and of Ukraine and of Ukrainian journalists.
Olga actually declined the first time she got the call.
And I just protested. I just said no. I mean, have you seen what other people in Ukraine are doing? There are people on the front lines fighting. There are people, you know, who are paramedics, and there are people who are volunteers sourcing supplies for the army and doing so many important things. But I agreed only after I asked whether anyone else from Ukraine is being considered, and they said no. And only then I said that, okay, yeah, I'm. Then, you know, of course it would be great to have somebody from Ukraine on the cover. But yeah, I asked the journalist, like, how many people have refused or tried to refuse being on the cover, and she just laughed and said it's a pretty small club.
The other journalist who has become another face for Ukrainian journalism covering this war is our defense reporter Ilya Ponomarenko. Over a million people look out for his updates on Twitter. When we spoke and sat down to record, he had just come back from a trip from Donbas in late May. He was staying in Slavyansk, a town I visited many times before, the hometown of many of my friends. The last few years, Slavyansk and Kramatorsk were continuing to grow. The active youth of the towns believed in a better future for Ukraine and their region. Just last fall, internationally renowned techno label Boiler Room had a rave in Slavyansk, with people from all corners of Ukraine making the trip to the eastern city, many for the first time. There, they were met with its salty lakes, beautiful nature, and the best pirozhki I've ever had in Ukraine. They saw the art programs out of Kramatorsk's youth center, Vilna Chata. Now, ghost towns.
They empty, absolutely empty. It's very hard to see any people. And it's not that they, you know, stay at home or something and do not show up in the streets. They're actually empty, you know, after dark, after, you know, when the curfew is on. It's very hard to find any, you know, window lights in the streets.
You're surrounded by complete and utter darkness. The only light source is the moon, if it's visible that night. When I previously spoke to Ilya for our Kyiv Independent podcast, we were discussing whether Russia was going to invade Ukraine or not. At the time, he didn't think so.
I was always saying that, you know, it's not likely that Russia is going to attack, because probably we have a good hope of Russia being not crazy, not that crazy. I mean, because, you know, attacking Ukraine with the force that they had was such a crazy, such a stupid idea. Obviously stupid idea. You don't have to be a military expert to understand this. It's just off the rails. It's just nuts. And basically what we see now is in many ways the result of this, you know, stupidity, outright stupidity. I think the biggest change from January or December, the biggest shift from that is the understanding that you cannot, absolutely cannot underestimate the stupidity of authoritarian, totalitarian regimes. And it's just, they can be so childishly stupid, so delusional, so driven by their own stupid lies.
Ilya has been reporting on the war of Donbas for many years, but he says there's a completely new reality of the way you report in Donbas compared to before. Playtime is over, he says. It's not even close to what we had 2 years ago. It's much harder to report from the front lines. The military won't allow it most of the time.
I get lots of people, I mean, foreign reporters, lots of people complaining about the fact that, you know, the military would not simply take journalists with themselves just to see. They know it that, you know, the military were pretty open in the previous years.
The Kyiv Independent was probably the only large media outlet to be deployed with soldiers in the previous 14 days when I spoke to Ilya.
Because It's been very complicated in there. It's been very complicated, and the military does not want to assume any responsibility. You know, they do not want journalists to be in there because it's, you know, basically they have killed or wounded soldiers.
Ilya estimates he devotes about 95% of his time to reporting, no matter what day or weather. Just like the military, he works 24/7. He thinks that the core of the Ukrainian journalistic community have decided to put all things away until the end of the war and sacrifice their whole lives until it is over. So what does Ilya's schedule look like?
It's checking what's going on in the war. It's checking what's going on in the war. It's checking what's going on with the war. It's checking what's going on with the war. And then writing things about this. And then getting some sleep. So yeah, like I said, many of us here, they do take this not as a job, but as a service. So as a service person, serving to, not to, you know, government, but to people, you know, you do things. It's not a job, 8 to 5. It's a service 24/7.
The war in Ukraine shifted into its third phase in Donbas and fourth phase in Kherson, the south. Russia failed to take Kyiv from the north and Kharkiv. A recent focus has been on Donbas, a battle that could very well determine the outcome of this war.
I think the outcome of the Battle of Donbas that is ongoing would be crucial, just because, you know, it would most probably end up leaving the Russian military in many ways exhausted to the point of not being able to go on offensive for a very long time, quite a long time. But behind this, we also need the factor of Western weapons, just because you have to, after the Russian military is exhausted, it is as a result of the Battle of Donbas, no matter how many, you know, cities and towns they have destroyed and seized, they would be simply exhausted to the point of not being able to do anything other than, you know, go on defensive and wait for Jesus to save them. But that would be quite the moment for the Ukrainian military to go on offensive, because the Ukrainian military is still, unlike the Russian military, they are fine in terms of, you know, manpower reserve. They have a lot of soldiers to replace all those exhausted, all those tired, all those killed.
Although Russia is experiencing severe losses, so is the Ukrainian army. Ukraine says it's losing around 30 soldiers a day now, as Western weapons have helped Ukraine to destroy Russian supplies, slowing down their offensive. But the Ukrainian army is still in desperate need of more large-caliber, long-distance weaponry. Then there's factor number two, the power of artillery and multiple-launch missile systems.
It defines the whole conflict. So whoever has the stronger and more effective artillery wins. It's just as simple as that. So that's why we are so eager in terms of, you know, those American guns coming here, because it's the weapon that gives you the most direct advantage and lays the ground for counteroffensives.
That is why the American howitzers, M777, and the HIMARS batteries are more effective with their longer striking distance. The West continues to be pushed to continue to supply Ukraine with weapons, and has promised to do so. And yet it's still not enough, and the human toll continues to rise. In the future of all of the temporarily occupied territories, from Donbas in the east to Kherson in the south, becomes more grim.
I think the key thing that people in the West and also in Ukraine, in media and beyond, they often miss this, is the immense tragedy of my people in my homeland, in my home region in Donbas, the tragedy of those people who we call them mobs, the mobilized people, the people who got mobilized forcibly, mobilized to the Russian military or the, you know, Russian sponsored militant formations, forcibly mobilized in large numbers to fight against Ukraine and fight and die.
Equipped with old Soviet helmets and lacking equipment, those mobs are not trained to fight in a war. They're just regular people, Ilya says. Taxi drivers, dentists, almost all men from the ages 18 to 55 in Russian-occupied territories are being forcibly mobilized to fight against the Ukrainian army.
There are lots of stories about, you know, places like, for instance, Avdiivka, where as long as your eye can see. You can see bodies of the dead in front of the in the battlefields, just because those are visual people not trained to fight.
The war is a great tragedy to all of Ukraine. We're losing a lot of soldiers, and the families of those soldiers will never see their sons and daughters again. Even though we're all awaiting Victory Day, when Ukraine will be fully free of Russia, it still won't bring back the thousands of people lost. Those in the occupied territories and cities are also losing immense numbers, as the Russian army uses able-bodied men as cannon fodder.
It's an immense tragedy. Based on what I can hear from the occupied territories, you know, we have lots of, you know, ears and eyes who tell us a lot about this. In many small towns or moderate middle-sized towns of Donetsk Oblast, of Luhansk Oblast, pretty much all of the able-bodied male population had been mobilized and sent to war. So in the end of the day, when this war is over, you know, the Russian-occupied Donbas may simply end up being very seriously depopulized in terms of working males of the age between 18 and 55 and killed by the Ukrainian troops just because they are used as soldiers against them for nothing. So it's an immense tragedy. And God knows what it brings since then after this war is over.
This Media in Progress podcast started as a way to introduce you to the team of journalists fighting for a better future of Ukraine. We wanted to document our efforts to establish an independent media and the minds and hearts behind such an endeavor. In a time of disinformation and propaganda, independent journalism is vital for the world to understand what is reality and what is not. At this point, we can safely say that the Kyiv Independent is a pretty established media, and isn't as much in the in-progress phase as it was in the months leading up to February 24th. And although much of the Kyiv Indie's success is unfortunately due to Russia's atrocious war in Ukraine, we understand our roles quite clearly. Our values haven't changed. Neither have our dreams. We understand the responsibility that comes with being the voice of Ukraine, and we have the perfect team to do just that. Our previous culture reporter, Artur Kornienko, like the rest of us, is fighting for Ukraine. As we fight on the informational front lines, Artur is now on the physical front lines with the Ukrainian armed forces. You can follow his Twitter at AK2KI_ to hear about his stories among the soldiers. You may even see a picture of him using his New Yorker tote to carry supplies, water, and makeshift wood to his brothers in arms. But his most recent tweets will also remind you of the cost of this war. There's a picture of a forest he took while in Donbas, now since occupied, where he wrote haikus under the mortars. His 26-year-old friend shot dead in front of him, while another died in his arms while he was trying to evacuate him under fire. He wrote, "I've bottled up grief, but tears poured when I heard this mother's last lullaby to her son. Eternal love is what remains of our brothers." His haiku reads, "The trees of my land cover from the whistling mortars, and I can fall asleep." The Kyiv Independent is no longer a media in progress, so this is the last episode of this mini podcast series. But not to worry, we have plenty of upcoming podcast shows in the near future, one of which is already out. Our national reporter, Anastasia Lopatina, and her colleagues host the Kyiv Independent's newest podcast, Did the War End? These three Ukrainians will try to answer some of the pressing questions on everyone's mind regarding the war, chatting with journalists, experts, and other Ukrainians to understand every aspect of the war that's changed our lives and is now shaping history. This podcast was written and produced by myself, Elina Liamkent. The music you heard used during this final episode was from the Ukrainian musicians Ship Her Son and Parking Spot. Thank you for listening. Slava Ukraini, glory to Ukraine.